is the Pop Medic podcast for October 14th, 2015. Welcome to my nightmare, listeners.
I'm scared.
The Pop Medic Podcast, where you could shock out with your library card out. I'm Sven Gulli, and joining me today are...
Amanda.
Sir Cecil Creep.
Zachary.
I'm Brian.
All right. As you can hear from the echo, we're recording in a secret vault underneath an unnamed cemetery in eastern Nashville. We made a deal with the ghouls and remnants who roam the grounds after midnight to have an hour alone to record a podcast. Do not ask us what we had to do for your entertainment, listeners. And in a completely unrelated note, RIP former podcast host Greg. And because regular host asked me to say it twice, a special note to listeners. The Podmatic podcast will be on hiatus for a few weeks while our regular host slash editor Brian searches the swamps of Florida for the dreaded Gillman. Stay tuned to the off-the-shelf blog on Wednesdays for posts written by our other Popmatic hosts in convenient word form.
I've called it the Popmatic Printcast.
Ooh,
yeah,
I like that.
Yeah,
it pops.
Magically.
We will return to our regular schedule on November 11th, or sooner if Brian can wrangle a young Clint Eastwood to help him search for the elusive creature of the Black Lagoon. This week, we celebrate all things Shocktober. But what be this Shocktober, you ask? Why, it was a few years ago when I expanded my yearly Halloween tradition of horror books and movies to encompass all of October, and I needed a catchy nickname. And I mostly say it to bug my sister because it drives her insane. Hey, Lily, how's your Shocktober going? Stop it! It's not funny.
That, of course, makes it funny.
Yes, I know. Siblings rule, listeners. Now, every year, I return to my youthful habits of being bored and disappointed by horror movies and books, leaving the rest of the year to be bored and disappointed by art films and literary fiction. Oh, boy! It's super fun, you guys. And if you're horror inclined, I highly recommend it. But what devilish delights will the rest of the Podmatic crew tempt you with? I'm especially interested in what Amanda is going to pick up.
Oh, boy. You know that one episode of The Princess Diaries? It's really scary.
It's creepy, you.
Many episodes of Buffy would call
That's
that.
True. Buffy is scary.
Roseanne had excellent Halloween specials. Not, I don't know if you like Roseanne. Mm. But she's a woman!
Joss Whedon wrote on her show.
Oh, that's correct. So, there you
yeah.
go.
Yeah. Amanda, what do you have this week? Shocktober.
Well, I'm okay to do this because I have a buddy. My friends aren't here to save me. So in 2005, a new crime novel from Sweden was kind of all the talk in Europe and the United States. It's obviously talking about the girl with the dragon tattoo, and it became a big controversial hit. Some people thought it was great. Some people thought it was stupid. Its author, Stieg Larsson, had actually passed away in 2004 before it was ever published. And this was the first book that came out in what ended up being called the Millennium Trilogy, probably because it dealt with the span over time over the millennium. The other two books in the series were The Girl Who Played with Fire and The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest. You know, of course, Hollywood followed, both in Sweden and in America, releasing movies. And for a while, it seemed like this was kind of the It series that everybody was talking about. But, you know, like I said, Larsson had already passed away, so the publishers couldn't really do anything else because he was dead and couldn't write anymore. Or could they?
Could it be the zombie Stieg Larsson?
The zombie, they reanimated him from the grave and made him, no.
The girl who ate the hornet's brains.
That's right. So recently, they did not reanimate Stieg Larsson, but they found a new writer whose name I can't find. David Lagerkrantz.
That cannot be a real name.
Where's Guildenstern?
Also Schwede, yes, and Rosencrantz. So he released the book called The Girl in the Spider Web, which continues the life of Mikael Blomkvist and Elizabeth Salander, just kind of in the same genre that like Eric Lustbader has continued Robert Ludlum's Jason Bourne series. So we're going back to talk with our crazy girl hacker and her investigative reporter. But Amanda, you're thinking these are mystery books, not horror books. How do they fit into Shocktober? And Mike's nodding his head.
It's a spider.
I'm trying to stretch. It has been well documented that I'm not a big fan of scary things. But I felt like these books fit in because they all have this certain level of sadism that kind of underlies the whole plot line, especially misogynistic state. Like, it's all about men hating women. And actually, in Swedish, the original book was titled Men Who Hate Women. That's what he had called it. And
pretty blunt.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the stories that, why he wrote this book was that he had witnessed his friend, whose name was Lisbeth, being gang raped. And so this kind of, apparently that's like one of the rumors. Ooh. Yeah, so that's kind of a tough, and like, she never apparently talked to him after that because he could have apparently like stopped it and he didn't, so.
Okay.
So that's, but you know, this is about as dark as I can reasonably get and not have nightmares every night. So the premise with the new book is that the NSA gets hacked and a brilliant scientist who's researching AI and quantum computers goes missing. And he has an autistic son that is a witness, but he doesn't really speak. So they're trying to deal with that. And then Millennium, which we all know is Blomkvist magazine, is in financial trouble. So initially I think I was drawn to this series because of the computer hacker angle. It's not really something I have a lot of skill in. Basically I can turn it on and turn it off, my computer. So I think that I appreciate the genius more because I don't completely understand it. And then also on top of the fact that Elizabeth gets to, you know, finger quotes, take care of bad guys by robbing them, embarrassing them, shutting them down, and getting rich off of that makes it even better. Now, with the new book and the new author, I will make two observations. One, you can tell it's a different writer. The voice isn't quite the same. And two, I don't think it was translated very well. Some of the text, because it was written in Swedish, and the text gets a little lumpy in places, and I was reading it, and I'm thinking, that doesn't really work like that in English. So, I don't speak Swedish, so I can't compare, but the story
they
was...
call Swedish meatballs balls made of meat.
Or meat.
How we drive our Volvos to IKEA.
So I think the story was still good. It's still worth reading because I like Lisbeth so much. I was going to end by saying that I'm glad that she's on our side, but I think that Lisbeth is really only on Lisbeth's side, and we're just kind of happy to be along for the ride.
She's chaotic neutral for sure.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that does seem to share a lot of plot points with the scariest film, Furious 7. Anyway, what spooktacular delights do you have, Brian?
Oh, I wanted to be subtly creepy today.
Ooh.
I'm actually kind of saddened. It saddens me, but today I do want to talk about the work of Catherine Coulson. Coulson was an actor who passed away September 28th, just a few weeks ago, September 28th of this year. Now, Coulson is best known for playing Margaret Lanterman, a.k.a. the Log Lady, on Twin Peaks. And though it was a small role, it became synonymous with the show.
Who's the lady with the log?
I would call her the Log Lady.
Log Lady.
Right.
Hi.
Can I ask her about our log? Many have.
So the hook of Twin Peaks is that it's a small town in the Pacific Northwest. I think I've heard this story before.
Oh, Pacific Northwest,
So the town is shattered when the prom queen is found dead, washed up on a riverbank, wrapped in plastic. Now, of course, in stories like this, we all know that the Rotary Club is deep into sex and drugs. But perhaps what makes Twin Peaks more sinister is that there's something living in the woods. It's almost Lovecraftian.
Ooh.
So those in Twin Peaks, the good people of Twin Peaks, know that there's evil in the woods, and they do everything they can to hold it in check. Now, one of these good people is Margaret Lanterman. Now, her husband was killed by a forest fire. His spirit is in the log that she carries around all the time, hence the name Log Lady. Now, the world of Twin Peaks is divided into good guys, bad guys, and chaotic neutrals. And I think some would argue that the Log Lady is chaotic neutral, but I think she's really one of the good guys. But she's been debilitated either by her trauma from her husband dying or this esoteric knowledge that she seems to have. She possesses this shamanistic aspect. I think this is a lot of her appeal. One of her branches seems to be in the spirit world and another branch seems to be in the real world.
Branches, that log.
Yeah. Or maybe she's just a little bit off her rocker.
You wear shiny objects on your chest.
Yes, I do.
Are you proud?
No, achievement is its own reward. Pride obscures it. Cream?
My log has something to tell you. Do you know it?
I don't believe we've been introduced.
I do not introduce the log. Can you hear it?
No, ma'am, I cannot.
I will translate. Deliver the message. Do you understand?
Yes, ma'am. As a matter of fact, I do.
The magic realist aspect to Margaret is, like, I think one of the good things about the show. You know, is she mentally ill or does she really possess some sort of spiritual, natural power? Like, we don't know. This also kind of forces us to ask the question, like, how people with mental illness are portrayed on TV, whether it's a positive or negative portrayal. Those who know me know that I'm fascinated with those sorts of questions. In a lot of ways, the Log Lady is treated with a lot of respect, but at the same time, I think to just assume that everyone who is, you know, sick possesses some sort of spiritual gift is probably a dangerous, self-destructive thing to do. But she is a fascinating character that people who love the show totally love. If you've never watched Twin Peaks before, the fall is a perfect time to watch Twin Peaks. You know, it's set in the Pacific Northwest. There's all these pine trees. It's a really great atmosphere. And in some ways, Twin Peaks is this irreverent take on a soap opera, but then it swings into this very nightmarish surrealism. There are, even though there were only, maybe 33 episodes of the show, five of them are straight up horror nightmares that you will never forget.
Scary to this day.
Yeah, totally horrifically scary. Cannot shake them. And also, as you probably have heard, there'll be new episodes after 25 years coming out next year. So now's a really good time to get caught up. The library has them on DVD. They've been streamed for free a number of different ways over the years, but now that the show is coming back, I think that they'll probably put those behind a paywall.
The DVDs have, you can watch each episode with the Log Lady intro, too.
Yeah, yeah. Like on one of the cable networks that did reruns, they had these Log Lady intros, so it was Catherine Coulson in character giving these intros, these cryptic intros, and but of course fans of the show are like, what's it mean? Is she talking about what, you know?
Like, it's like sitting in front of a fireplace or
yeah,
something.
Everyone's always trying to decode what she was going to be. Now, of course, one of the questions this brings up is, you know, if she was going to be in the new episodes, and I mean, as far as I know, she was, they pretty much got the whole cast back, at least for one episode, one of the new episodes, so she obviously can't be in it anymore, and I don't know if that's going to change the plans on the show. The show, the production is of the new episodes are pretty much on total lockdown, so I don't know how that will affect the plot of the new episodes if she was going to be in them, but now she's not around. So
there's supposed to be a book that comes out before the show aired. I thought it was coming out this fall, but I think the schedule got pushed back, right, because Lynch dropped out for a while.
Well, I heard that 2017 is the year that the episodes will actually come out, but there will be a book written by Mark Frost, a novel, before that. I just want to say, this is, I guess we're talking about the Log Lady, I want to put this out there. The Log Lady's husband's spirit is in the log, and that actually is the key to explaining one of the most controversial and hated episodes in the second season that no one understands or gets, but spirits will go into wood.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, I'll have to remember to log on to Netflix later and watch that one. A Jeremy-style pun. I'll just blame all my bad puns on Jeremy. So, what do you got, Bill?
Well, for Shocktober, I'm going to talk about a cartoonist who needs to be seen instead of described. The cartoon artist is Gahan Wilson, whose drawings are weird, strange, macabre, witty, and intelligent. Or as Hugh Hefner once said, Gahan Wilson moves to a different drummer. Speaking of Hugh Hefner, the library has four volumes of Gahan Wilson's cartoons called Gahan Wilson, 50 Years of Playboy Cartoons. You can see all of Mr. Wilson's cartoons without the interviews, articles, or excellent photography. Also, on Hoopla, you can stream Gahan Wilson, Born Dead, Still Weird, an excellent documentary about the cartoonist. Now, I'm going to do something, I'm going to try to describe one of his cartoons in another book the library has called Gahan Wilson's Gravedigger's Party. Now, I put this up as a screensaver, and Amanda actually laughed at it. She got into this macabre cartoon. It's a patient and an eye doctor, and he's reading the eye chart, and it says, I am an insane eye doctor, and I'm going to kill you now as you sit reading this. And behind the patient is a doctor with a Norman Bates butcher knife about to plunge it into the man's back. So, it's stuff like that. I guess I did a pretty good description because people are laughing.
I hate
and
the
so,
eye doctor.
So, that's what I'm recommending, Gahan Wilson. And Jeremy, passing it to you.
I will also talk about a strange cartoonist. So if you think you've heard the name Steve Ditko before, you have.
Mike Ditko.
Da Bears.
Da Bears.
He's the coach of the Chicago Bears, the scariest man in America.
Bears.
No, that would
mustache.
Be...
Ooh.
This is the masculine form of Ditko. Ditko.
Ditko, I'm sorry, I misheard.
He's the co-creator of Spider-Man, the man responsible for the character's amazing costume and Randian undertones. Ditko also co-created Marvel's Doctor Strange, a character whose anonymity will vanish in the blink of the eye of Agamotto once he's Cumberbatched on the big screen in 2016.
Dormammu, ha ha ha.
But before becoming the Holy Ghost of the Marvel Trinity, and that would be Jack Kirby as the father, Stan Lee as the son, and Ditko as the Holy Ghost, Steve Ditko illustrated dozens of horror and monster tales for a number of publishers, including the Marvel precursor Atlas Comics. And the best of these stories is collected in Strange Suspense, the Steve Ditko Archives, Volume 1. This book came out from Fantagraphics Publishing, a purveyor of many fine comics, and is edited by Blake Bell. Bell also wrote a biography of Steve Ditko, which you could get through ILL or borrow from me, called Strange and Stranger, The World of Steve Ditko. The stories are all originally appeared between 1953 and 1955, and comics like This Magazine is Haunted, Black Magic, Space Adventures, and others. And the time that they were published sort of predates and goes right into the era of the Comics Code Authority, which was created in 1954 as a reaction to these to Tennessee senators' congressional hearings saying that comic books caused juvenile delinquency, and it basically neutered horror comics and crime comics and made everything sort of Leave It to Beaver-y. Except not, but still. A lot of these stories were published by Charlton, but they're not all horror in this book. There's also some Western romance and crime, because like all the other freelance illustrators of his generation, Steve Ditko did it all. But his horror stuff is especially good. He really excels at drawing these facial expressions, which with bad guys are sort of filled with sadistic glee, and then like good guys sort of in agonizing pain. There's a really famous sequence in Amazing Spider-Man number 33 in which Spider-Man is lifting this gigantic machine up while water pours all around him, and like the ghosts of his family are talking to him. But the characters in Steve Ditko horror stories all look like they're kind of experiencing the struggle, the same kind of struggle internally, with sweat pouring from their brows and their teeth kind of gritted. There's something in the lines and the faces that he does which captures the feeling of old school terror very well. The book has really great reproductions of these old comics pages. It's like they're scanned directly from old comics rather than having this sort of BS remastered color. It sort of retains the four color goodness rather than the saturated colors of, because it's like you're actually reading the comic in its, you know, intended setting rather than somebody tweaking it on a computer. And these are all twist-ending stories, like he was dead all along, and, you know, the pretty lady is a monster kind of stuff. There are monsters and haunted houses and crime schemes gone wrong, all kind of classic setups that you find on The Twilight Zone or Tales from the Crypt or Creepshow. I have a really romantic view of this era of comics. I'm just seeing... this time in general, the sort of seeing pictures of newsstands is like boudoir photography to me. After leaving Marvel in the mid-60s, Steve Ditko created characters like Hawk and Dove, The Creeper, and Shade the Changing Man at DC, The Question for Charlton, which was later purchased by DC, and Speedball and Squirrel Girl back at Marvel in the 1980s. The really scary thing is that almost 88 years of age, Steve Ditko is still alive and still making comics.
Still being a creepy recluse, not talking to anybody.
Exactly.
J.D. Salinger style.
He is 100% J.D. Salinger of comics, Thomas Pynchon of comics. His contemporary work is largely self-published, and much of it is sort of like objectivist philosophical tracts disguised as superhero comics. And there's a really great documentary that you can find on YouTube. There was a BBC documentary called In Search of Steve Ditko. It's hosted by Jonathan Ross of the BBC. So, Crypt Keeper Mike, what's shocking your tober?
You know. Well, gang, well, I thought I'd bring up while you're talking about the comics code. You know, Morbius, the vampire in Marvel Comics, you know, he couldn't suck blood from a neck because that was in the comics
code. Oh, sure, yeah.
So he had to leech their blood through suckers in his hands. Which was ridiculous.
Ridiculous. Wow. Yeah, there was all kinds of stuff like that. Like, not only with the horror stuff, but, like, police couldn't be portrayed as bad guys, and, like, authority figures couldn't be portrayed as bad guys, and, yeah.
See, comics code kind of comes in with what I'm talking about today. Ooh. See, yeah, it's almost like I planned this. All right, so let's take a ride, boils and ghouls, to the in the Wayback Machine.
I can't find that sound.
Wayne's World.
In the 1980s, anthology shows were all the rage. Amazing Stories, Tales from the Dark Side, revamps of what Hitchcock Presents and The Twilight Zone, all of them were garbage. But one reality or one anthology show would arise from the poop.
Correction! Don't bring me
down! I think Bill just threw don't mean to bring it down card just with a facial expression.
So was there an episode of Tales from the Dark Side that was good that I missed?
Oh yeah, Wordpresser of the Gods.
Oh okay.
That's Stephen King. Yeah.
That was my favorite too.
I don't know, everyone I'd see would just be like, you know, they're on a train going to hell. I knew this. Why don't they just say it in the first 3 minutes of the episode? Anyway. Whoa.
One in the twist.
See, I thought that the twist would be this time is that I'd recommend like Gone with the Wind or something. No one would expect that.
Spanish Inquisition.
That's right. It's set in Georgia, and that's the only good thing I can say about it. only one anthology show. It spawned multiple spinoffs, including a cartoon show for children, and 3 albums, including a Christmas album and an all metal album. That would be horror classic Tales from the Crypt.
Tales from the Crypt.
Before we get ahead of ourselves, I'd like to point out the library does not own Tales from the Crypt. You may recall that Michael also did this last year with a 10-minute feature on Creepshow, which the library also did not own at the time of recording. Sometime in the future, the library will have replacement copies of all 7 seasons of Tales from the Crypt. But until then, you can pregame with the Tales of the Crypt soundtrack, which the library does own. Thanks, Mike.
Tales from the Crypt began with a brilliant title sequence with music by Danny Elfman, which Brian can play right now. The host of the show was the Crypt Keeper, which would appear to be a skeleton with very little flesh left, was actually a puppet controlled by 6 puppeteers. Good stuff. Voiced by actor John Cassier. I was a big fan of Old Crypty, as he used a variety of violence/horror-based puns to juice every episode. My sister, who, like, you know, we'd have little marathons when the DVDs would come out, would skip that, and I'd be like, whoa, where's the puns? I need me some puns.
If I had a nickel for every time I've heard that.
You'd not have a nickel.
I'll do anything.
As befitting an anthology show, each episode had different actors and a different director. Sometimes these new actors and directors would make headlines. Like Arnold Schwarzenegger, notably a cyborg sent from the future, made his directorial debut on the episode The Switch in season 2. Robert Zemeckis, known mainly for
terrible animated films like Beowulf and Polar Express. And I can see Bill try to like say good movies that he's made, but I'm
Back to the Future. Yeah. Right?
Yes.
Back to the Future? Are you going to take a dump on Back to the Future?
It's overrated. And who seemingly only feels comfortable when it's...
The sequels are overrated.
I will give any film with Crispin Glover a chance.
Hey, you. This is your cousin, Marvin. Marvin Barry. That's brilliant.
That movie's awesome.
You know, I thought that, like, maybe I should revisit it or something when I talked over with my parents. They were like, yeah, it's the only movie we ever walked out of.
What? Oh,
wow.
Aww. Yeah, that's not bad.
Yeah.
Tough house in my town.
No kidding. My goodness. Jesus. Yeah. It's no Hiroshima Mon Amour, but...
I prefer Battle of Algiers.
Or more La Font. Yeah.
Robert Zemeckis,
who seemingly only feels comfortable lately, where he could, you know, horrifically animate his actors, directed an episode called You Murderer in season six, which featured an animated Alfred Hitchcock and an animated Humphrey Bogart. And also John Lithgow and Isabella Rossellini basically playing her mom. It's not very good. The episode that I always remember most was Split Personality, starring Joe Pesci, in season four.
Ooh, typecasting.
My crown here to amuse you. They would air, HBO would air marathons of episodes once a year, and usually showcasing the previous season, and I would tape them off TV. Split Personality was the first episode on one of the tapes. My sister, who's like the patron saint of this episode, would borrow my tape collection when I went off to college, and still watches that episode every Halloween. When she visited for Shock Tempo.
Low blow.
We watched that episode, and I was like, you know, I forget, what happens at the end? And she, like, her jaw could not drop any farther. Mike.
Shock Tempo. It'd be like sepsis temper.
Gross.
I don't know.
Gross. She began her horror marathon in September, and my first poster on Facebook was, Shock Tempo? And she's like, no, Mike.
Your poor sister.
Siblings are the best. Since this was on the aforementioned HBO, every episode I get gratuitous nudity or violence or both. Fun fact, I looked at the back of the latest DVD that I purchased and discovered that I watched the season premiere when I was 11. I'm pretty sure I watched it with my dad too. Now that's parenting.
Well, then you can talk about why it scares you. It's a learning experience.
The seeds of Shocktober were sown that very Halloween when I was 11, dear listeners, to bring it back for you. See, I discovered that year that Tales from the Crypt was based on comic books published in the 50s, which alas are unavailable through NPL, yay, ILO.
Yeah. Woohoo!
I would save them until after trick-or-treating, sitting in my room promising awesomeness for weeks on end. I discovered a little something that summer, that winter, fall, whatever the season is, called
autumn.
Delayed gratification, kids. It's super fun. That's why I go tantric every year.
Wow.
All right.
Wow.
Two things.
Oh, boy.
Tales from the Crypt. Robert Zemeckis directed, in my opinion, the best episode of Tales from the Crypt, Ooh. Which is Yellow. Which
yes,
starred
yes.
Kirk Douglas and his son, who's now deceased, I think, named Eric Douglas.
Huh. I read the Wikipedia thing researching this, and apparently that was part of a pilot that they did as a spinoff of Tales from the Crypt. That was all shock suspense story stuff.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Apparently it didn't sell, so they split it into three, and that was one of them. Uh-huh. I think it won an Emmy or a Cable Ace Award.
Could be, yeah. And the second thing is, once again, my interviews with Legends of Cinema,
Ooh,
I interviewed Walter Hill, who was the executive producer, and he talks about the origins of the series, of how that got to be. It was going to be a feature film first, and then the Twilight Zone movie came out and just bombed, just a total bomb. And so Joel Silver came in and he noticed in Walter Hill's office all these Tales from the Crypt magazines, because he was a big fan, and he says, can I have them? And said, then he went and struck a deal with HBO, and that's how the show
cool.
started.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Mike.
Hey.
What do we do on Tickle My Fancy?
Yeah.
Well,
maybe the library has it. Maybe the library doesn't. But either way, it's tickling our fancy.
you have a
process
other than green.
Okay.
Zombie tickle my fancy. Brains. So delicious.
Brains.
That's just all I said.
Brains. Yeah, everywhere. Brains.
Man, zombie, brains. Why do you keep bringing you back to this?
So, okay, you guys got to geek out about Shocktober, and I'm going to geek out about my tickle my fancy.
Sure.
Because I got to meet Ruth Reichel. Podcast listeners might remember that I picked two of her books from my favorites of last year, Garlic and Sapphires, as my non-fic pick, and then Delicious for Fiction. And she's a food writer. She was the former New York Times food critic, as well as the editor-in-chief of Gourmet magazine. So when Gourmet shut its doors in 2009, Reichel was suddenly, you know, without a job, and she fictionalized a lot of, like, closing down her office and cleaning it out in her book Delicious, but the whole episode really kind of spiraled her down into a depressive state, and in order to heal, she decided to cook, because that's what she does. She chronicled her journey in her newest book called My Kitchen Year, 136 Recipes That Saved My Life. And so she also, as part of, you know, this new book tour, she's on tour and promoting her book, and she visited NPL with our Salon at 615, where she had a chat with Ann Patchett about her book and the process she went through as she was writing it. Now, this is only the second one of these events I've ever attended. The first one I went to was Eric Larson when he came several years ago, and it was awesome. I love Ruth Reichel. She's funny. She's smart. I got to ask her a question. I asked her what the worst thing was she ever ate, and she said that it was langoustines with cinnamon, and then she signed my copy of the book, and I'm totally gonna go all fangirl over the whole thing.
What is the cinnamon dish? What is that?
Langoustines, it's kind of like a lobster's, like, shellfish. Oh. And like some, it was, she said it was Wiley Dufresne and his WD, I think it's WD 50 restaurant in New York, and like he served langoustines with cinnamon, and like she totally couldn't eat it.
Shellfish with
cinnamon? Yeah, gross. And so like she ended up like throwing it on the floor under her chair or something, because she can't send plates back to the rest. And she sometimes she said she would put baggies in her purse so she could hide it in her purse so she wouldn't make the chefs feel bad. But yeah, she appreciated the idea, but it did not work.
I can't imagine.
Sounds vile.
Throw some butter.
Wiley knows about it now.
Yeah. Hi, Wiley. Sorry.
Garlic
butter. So I'm the perfect person to live in Nashville, because by and large, I do not care about celebrities. You're just people. You're not important. Plus, I never know what to say. I would totally be like Chris Farley in that skit. Do you remember that one time? Do you remember? Sounds really cool.
This place is frequented by musicians, and I know nothing about music. Would just be like, hey, guy, how's it going? You don't know who I am? Nope.
I've had that moment.
What followed was a series of anecdotes about, quote, celebrities, unquote, here in Nashville. Listeners, I will spare you.
So anyway, so I think that maybe with Ruth, because I've read all of her books, except one really old cookbook that I'm trying to get through in her library loan, I felt like I knew her, and she was really gracious, and so I told her about the podcast, and so now maybe she'll be our newest listener, and give Gary from Perth, and Craig in HR, and Mike's dad some company.
Hi, Ruth.
So the library does have copies of her book, but there is a bit of a list on it, so you might have to wait a minute to get your copy, but while you're waiting, feel free to check out anything else she's written. It's all good. Go, Ruth Reichel! Yay! Woo! Also, I have to correction myself, is that I learned that I had been pronouncing her name wrong. It's Ruth Reichel, not Ruth Reichel.
Oh, my bad.
Yay!
Tickling My Fancy is an excellent documentary that aired on HBO earlier this year called Going Clear, Scientology and the Prison of Belief.
Yeah, scary, finally, come scary on, stuff dude. For real life.
Yeah.
Whose house? Ron's house.
All I'm going to say, it's jaw-dropping. It goes into the history of Scientology. It talks to ex-members. It's engrossing. I can't recommend it enough. Going Clear, Scientology, and the Prison of Beliefs.
I'm surprised they could talk to me.
That's excellent. I'm stoked for that movie. I read the book.
It's based on a book. There's a book.
Yeah. Lawrence Wright. It was a New Yorker article with Paul, director Haggis. Of Crash, Haggis. When he left the church, there was a New Yorker article called The Apostate, written by Lawrence Wright, and then that was like sort of like the nugget, the seed of the book, and then he wrote this book. It's good stuff. T and my F this week. There's a I don't know if it's gonna make it in, but we were talking about Roku a minute ago. And so I got the Roku and I got Netflix and Amazon Prime and all that stuff. But there's all these free channels that
you can have those.
Yeah. I'm an internet television man.
ITV.
Television man.
One-way channels and there's nothing
getting
on.
Caught
exactly.
In the web.
I don't watch television. I watch I look at the things that I could be watching, which is a problem. But I did come across a channel that my friend turned me on to called B-Movie TV. It's a free channel on Roku, and it's just a streaming channel. You click on it, it comes up, and whatever's playing is playing. You can't scroll through anything. I'm always coming across, I watched part of an action movie the other night where, a guy is holding up a gun and walking through this, maze of cardboard boxes, and then someone gets shot, and then, a guy, doesn't hear it, apparently, and then he gets shot, and it was horrible, but then the guy pretended to be shot, and then the guy came up on him with a gun, and then he was like, I'm not dead, and shot him.
You are now.
Ridiculous. It was like some actor who was, sub Brandon Lee kind of star, you know. But, so this past Friday, I was at home, and I got a text message from my friend in Chicago, and said, he's like, you gotta turn on B-Movie TV and watch this movie. And I came across Shock 'Em Dead, which is also known as Rock 'Em Dead. It's a rock and roll horror comedy from 1991, starring Stephen Quadros and Tracy Lords.
Two of my favorites.
I know Tracy Lords, okay.
Yes. Quadros plays Angel, a wannabe rock star who sells his soul to become the greatest guitar shredder on the planet. He's doing this shredding stuff, and then he instead of playing guitar the normal way, he goes over the top and is doing this.
Madman.
He joins
you
this
can't do
band.
That practicing.
No.
He joins
only
this
the
band.
Devil can do it.
He joins this band that they're playing, and the guy it's the music sounds like Def Leppard or Poison or something like that. But then the singer sounds like Fred Schneider from the B-52s. It's like, oh, you wanna be my girl? Hey, it's
I can't think of any more metal than Fred Schneider.
Rocket
Lobster.
I'm not even joking. Oh, stay in the water. Down.
What?
Down. It's called Shock 'Em Dead.
Oh, this sounds as good as Trick or Treat with Skippy. From Family Ties. Have you seen that?
That sounds excellent.
I remember
Ozzy Osbourne.
Oh.
And
he doesn't even remember he made the movie.
Gene Simmons.
Ah. Well, the only catch with Angel selling his soul, you know, is that he can't eat food anymore. He can only eat souls. And so he falls in love with Tracy Lords for some reason. And
of course she has no soul.
She's like a rock and roll manager. And she's going to help his career launch, and he takes over this band, and he's trying to eat her soul. But he has this guitar that it goes two ways. The next shootout on either side is playing them both ways.
Oh, this sounds awesome.
It has got ridiculous guitar shredding in it, and they're just really lame, some cool effects of the bodies dying and stuff. But
really lame what?
Really lame music, but all and outfits and stuff too, and
very 1991.
Very 1991. And this Fred Schneider singer guy, I don't know if it was some sort of making fun of a guy for being effeminate kind of thing or what, but it is the strangest. He's like, can you learn my songs? And the guy looks at a sheet of paper and he's like, I got them. It's just. Wow. Just absurd. So it was
also reminded of a film called Rock and Roll Zombies.
Oh,
by a zombie rock and roll band who takes on Hitler.
Oh, alas! There are many things I could recommend, but since we are going on hiatus soon, I'll focus on a few of the most exciting things.
Stared it down at 95, did you?
Trimming it down. Sorry, I skipped. I talked over your Skippy.
Tell us about some terrible movie that sounds way cooler than it actually is.
This one,
all of them?
That one really does live up.
That's why I stopped watching horror movies, because you'd be like, King Cobra starring George Takei and Eric Estrada. I'm there.
I would watch that.
Yeah, then you watch and your eyes melt out of your face.
Oh my! Sorry.
Starting at 10 p.m. Saturday, October 24th, is the Belcourt's annual 12 Hours of Terror. Ooh. I would suggest you do what I do and bring multiple 5-hour energies, for this thing lasts all night. As of this recording, this year's lineup is a bit of a mystery, but the promotional poster is a riff on The Thing's movie poster. They show The Thing, I'll either cry or poop my pants, or both. Very exciting. Next, I thought that I would briefly...
Is that an enjoyable experience?
Poop my pants from joy.
I'm happy to not sit next to you.
I hope you're wearing a pair of pants along with your 5-hour energy drink.
What is that stank? I smell joy.
If I drank 5-hour energy, I probably would have to poop my pants, because there's no way I'd be able to make it to that tiny bathroom with the belt.
Oh, that bathroom's the worst. That's one thing I'm looking forward to. Next, I thought
I
that
love
I would...
that bathroom. So I suited my needs.
And he doesn't drink 5-hour energy.
He moves in a dumpster in the back. Next, I thought that I'd briefly promote the idea of using your cereal milk instead of cream in your coffee. I've been flavoring my Columbia roast this week with frankenberry milk. It is like creating a taste monster from various parts. Whoa. My tongue is alive! Alive!
Wow.
Lastly, I thought I would mention...
That was worth mentioning. I don't
know. It's important.
It was.
It's delicious.
That's a taste sensation.
Yeah, usually I have Frosted Flakes, and Frosted Flakes has the sugar in it, so
yeah,
you know, extra sugar
would
with
work
the sugar.
As good with coffee,
And on Halloween Day, Ash vs. the Evil Dead premieres on Starz. Human words cannot convey how much Army of Darkness meant to be when I was a teen. I had never seen that kind of irreverent fantasy / horror / comedy kind of film before. I watched it so many times that even the most minor throwaway line pop into my head all the time. For example, when I'm watching a movie alone and someone is about to be betrayed, I say very loudly, "It's a trick, get an axe." Because, you know, they have the eyes open. I watched it last year, and it mostly holds up. The 70-minute running time. That was like, by the time I was like, okay, I'm getting kind of bored, and I looked at my watch, and I'm like, oh, there's like 2 minutes left. Okay.
Is it really only 70 minutes?
I believe it's less than 80.
Jesus.
It's short. For a
feature
film.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, kind of amazing. Maybe they were a little looser in 1993.
I was.
Yeah, that's right. 13-year-old Jeremy.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that was 8th grade.
Hey, I have my jeans. Like, it's got elastic in the waistband.
Ass wash jeans.
That's cool.
Mom jeans with the peg on the bottom.
No, but hey.
You had hair then?
Drew my hairline.
Getting dirty.
Oh, my. I've followed the incredibly spotty career of lead actor Bruce Campbell for way more than I should have.
I like Bruce Campbell.
He's great, but man.
Burn Notice?
Seriously.
I got nothing.
That's pretty good.
That terrible late season episode of The X-Files. Where
he's a demon? Briscoe County Jr. is all right, you know, the first season. I think it's one season, I guess, but they tried to, at the very last episode, they're like, we're going to do a spinoff, and it's like, nah, who cares.
So before we're done, since you dissed both Tron and The Exorcist, I just want to say that Army of Darkness, I think, besmirches the...
let you down, card.
The glory of Evil Dead 1 and Evil Dead 2.
Don't bring me down!
I mean, the only time in the history...
All of them are good.
The only time in the history of cinema that a remake and the original are both effing awesome, and then they make this crappy tack-on disaster called Army of Darkness.
Whoa. Ooh.
Don't mean to bring you down.
Wasn't it more like a wasn't it like a...
It is only because you said something about Tron earlier than being there.
I'm surprised that you're so,
I didn't even know you liked Tron.
Tron doesn't...
It's like some fandom of yours that, you completely, who knew about? Cause
and you were like, you didn't even complete the thought, but you're like, I prefer Daft Punk over... The composer on Tron was Wendy Carlos. Frida.
He is now.
Basically.
Army of Darkness is really fun. Just check it out. Really funny movie.
Anyway, Ash vs. Evil Dead has also got Lucy Lawless in another... connection because he was on that show.
Did you know Brian also loves The Last Starfighter?
I like Star Crash, speaking of bad movies.
Crash is fun.
Is that the science fiction sequel to Crash?
Corrections. Who has corrections, guys?
I have a lot of corrections. No, I have two, three, maybe no, one. 47. Wait, I have 2.5.
Okay.
Correction.
Okay.
Man, you said in the 1938 or 1939 Olympic Committee decided to have the games in Berlin, but I think you meant the 1928 or
1931.
Okay.
Wow. So none of those years.
Yeah, so,
yeah, like the war was on in 38
yeah, yeah.
39.
So, I mean, I knew that was a mistake, but I didn't
put it. Yeah, because it was 31 into the 36th Olympics.
I didn't put a correction in because I didn't know what year it actually was, but I knew that that
I thought that sounded weird. In my head, I knew it was 31, but it did sound weird, whatever I said, so.
Yeah. So, it was the 31 Olympic Committee decided to have the games in Berlin again 36. In 1936.
Yes.
The little musical snippet at the beginning of the show was the Wiener Schnitzel Polka from the album Oktoberfest, which is available on Freegal. There were many Oktoberfest albums with that title on Freegal. This is the one by Celebration Sounds, which really just kind of sounds like they ripped it directly from cassette, you know? Which we have songs which may or may not...
That makes it authentic-er.
Yeah. May or may not be in the public domain.
Authentic-er is the German word for
authentic. That's right. There's a K at the end.
Exactly.
You could just look for the Oktoberfest album with the sexist cover. Oh, wait, that's all of them.
That's the point. Although the Lederhosen for Men is a ridiculous short styling. Also, a correction, Rammstein rules. All right, so for... More information on Rammstein and Oktoberfest Lederhosen albums, you can go to
www.library.nashville.org.
And our theme music is by
Adam Dean.
A reminder that we will be on hiatus for a few weeks because our regular host/editor Brian will be hunting vampires in his ancestral homeland of Pennsylvania. PopMedic contributors have pledged to continue in word form on the shelf blog. We hope to return to our regularly scheduled programming on November 11th. If Brian can successfully banish the scourge of vampirism plaguing southern Pennsylvania? You know, the bit that he cares about. Not northern Pennsylvania. That could be dripping with vampire fangs for all he cares. When we return, we'll be talking about...
Fall books.
That's right, the fall books preview. Because when I'm chugging on leftover candy and dreaming of turkey, my mind automatically goes to books, I guess. Happy Halloween and Canadian Thanksgiving, listeners.
I gotta get this in that George Romero made a great vampire movie set in Pennsylvania.
Martin. The best vampire movie ever.
Anyway. Oh,
I believe that.
Awesome movie about Pittsburgh too. Like one of the best Pittsburgh movies ever, Martin.
That's why when I have to catalog stuff for kids, and sometimes I'll just turn to Susan, it's like, so a character gets beheaded in this, is it okay for kids? And she's like, no. And I'm like, it's not bloody.
Someone has to be the voice of reason.
Yeah, you know.
I would just like to point out that no one in my family would ever watch any of these episodes. Like, your whole family watches them together, makes popcorn.
Oh, yeah.
My family's like, no.
I got a text from my mom. She's like, we're watching fourth or fifth horror movie this month. And she's like, so Mike, is Sinister any good? I'm like, I haven't seen it. Leslie likes it. She's like, never mind. She's got bad taste.
But you walked out on Back to the Future. One of the funnest... like most beloved hit like family movies ever made. All right,
it wasn't gory enough for the joke.
Hey, you know, you'd have to bring this up with my family.
I hate manure.
Are you guys? Is this like Texas Chainsaw Massacre family, or what is this like?
This is the 10th library I've worked in before. I've had to devour all the other podcasts.
Does your mom live like under a couch on a little rolly cart?
Oh!
No offense to Mike's mom.
She will never listen to this. Okay. It's totally okay. I've tried recommending this to her multiple times.
We're not scary enough. We're like the Back to the Future.